Okay, well, good morning, everyone, and or good noon here in the Temple of Silence. I'm continuing with a treatise on white magic rules for the astral plane. We're on page 387. The last program that I made was about an hour and a half. It was an analysis of that ancient Atlantean chant, which, because of its power, even though it has fallen out of use, as the Tibetan says, because it's probably millions of years old, it is one of my favorites because it seems to promote the ability to identify with the substratum out of which all things come. At least the universal substratum. And this identification indicates to us that we are that very substratum. So, in a strange sort of way, all things, all perceptions arise out of what we are, out of us. You know, every one of us can say, out of me, capital M-E, out of me, all things. Well, now we're going on. He tells us that that ancient formula was chanted on peculiar and selected notes, and it was very potent, and it brought definite results. Long ago, the ceremonies have died out, and who knows what he means by long ago? It could be hundreds of thousands of years. Anyway, they were Atlantean, and we can only imagine the what is found, the books, the whatever form the books may take, in these repositories to which the hierarchy has access. Well, the day will come, and according to need, we will use them when the time comes. Okay. There are three concise statements apparently made above, and let's just see if I can find them now. I got so caught up. Yeah. Well, work on the mental plane produces realization of duality. That's the first one. The mind, rightly used, becomes a recorder of two types of energy or of two aspects of the manifestation of the one life. And later, the soul and its instrument become so unified and at one that the duality disappears and the soul knows itself to be all that is, all that has been, and all that will be. And I would have to add, you know, for my own comfort in that statement, that that which is being plus the consciousness which the soul is knows itself to be all that is, all that has been, and all that will be. And you know, that's a bit of a stretch for most of us, but I think in a very subtle way it does come through eventually. Now, here is the fourth. Here is the fourth. When the citta or mind stuff is swept into activity by abstract ideas, the embodied thoughts of the abstract mind, notice embodied, because when we're dealing with intuitions, we may not yet have embodiment. The embodied, excuse me, thoughts of the divine mind, carrying the energy of their creator and consequently the cause of phenomenal effects in the three worlds. And when to this is added divine understanding and synthetic apprehension of the will and purpose of God, then the three aspects of the mind are unified. And this is one way of looking at that which is unified, the mind stuff, or citta, and that's of the lower mind, the abstract mind, which relates at this time to the first subplane of the mental plane and the intuition or pure reason. It is of the Buddhic plane, and especially, I suppose, relates, if we call it intuition, to the fourth subplane of the Buddhic plane. So I'm going to, you know, whoops, what has caused that? All right. Want to make that a little bigger? With hope. I've been away from this computer for just a day, and it's too long. Too long. Yeah. Okay. So, the mind stuff, the citta, and the intuition, the mind stuff or citta, abstract mind, and intuition. Now, there's another way to look at three minds uniting. Well, there are several ways to look at three minds uniting, and one way is the lower concrete mind, the son of mind, I suppose, mind as it is found on the second and third levels of the mental plane. We might call it higher mind, and then the abstract mind. Those are different ways of considering the three minds that unite, and there are still other ways as well. But this is a somewhat higher way, because it involves the intuition. Okay, so here are the three minds which have to unite into a seamless unity, so one can move without obstruction between one level and another level, and they all relate to each other, and they all reinforce each other somehow. So these have to be unified in the consciousness of the aspirant, and when this has happened, the disciple has built the bridge, the antiskarana, which links. Let's get that. Links the spiritual triad, the causal body, and the personality, and we do see, you know, if we. Okay. Let's see if I can get this. Correct. These are Tuya's diagrams, and you notice that this antikarana is triangular in a way. The abstract mind is here. The causal body is here, and there's a line from it appears to be the center of the causal body, and then the mental unit is at the top of the threefold personality. So here, via this triangle, the three are linked together. Okay, so an interesting way of considering that the antikarana is built, the entire antikarana. And when the mind stuff, the abstract mind, and the intuition are linked, and notice in this case, he leaves out the causal body, it appears. Okay. Just trying to get my bearings here. When you stay away from it for just a little while, you have to regain. Okay. When this has happened, and let's just say, note that he leaves causal body out of the picture at first. But the triangular antikarana does not leave it out in the charts. So, let's just say when the personality via the mental unit, the causal body, the son of mind, and the abstract mind, and the intuition are linked, then we certainly have the the Antikorana and or Antaskarana, as it's sometimes called, and we can go further with the building of that Antikorana, including the Atmic spiritual will, and finally the monad itself. And even then, that Antikorana continues, in a way, the way back to identification of one's true self as the universal logos increases in intensity as we continue to retrace our steps via the emanatory stream, and that retracing is called Antikorana. And it goes all the way to the height of the universe, and when the universe dissolves, as ever it does, in the great pralaya, we are reintroduced to the post-universal and or pre-universal world, the supernumeral realm of absolute infinity, as perceived by the universal logos, and finally absoluteness itself, completely immutable. Of course, those things are infinitely beyond any mind in cosmos, at least according to my opinion, which can be corrected, you know, as time goes on and as I see and understand more. So these are the links that must occur. And I wonder, as we look at the condition, our condition, whether we have in any way done this. What is linked in our own particular case? I know many people who have linked the abstract mind and the mind stuff, and they have to bring in the love energy of the higher mind, the Venusian aspect, we might say. Sometimes when I look at the higher mind, or the three subplanes of the higher mental plane, I think of the third and the second as Venusian, and the very first subplane as Mercurian. I always try to translate things into planetary terms because it seems to be a language which is revelatory. But DK has told us that, you know, we just don't yet, the majority, know how to center consciousness in a stable way within the causal body. And this we must learn to do if we're going to have a true meditation of the kind that he is trying to induce in us. So when all this is done, the egoic body has served its purpose. The solar angel has done its work. And the form side of existence, including that form which we call causal body, as we understand and utilize it, because, you know, there are higher forms that we don't understand and do not utilize. In a way, the whole cosmic physical plane is consisting of nothing but form. Although those forms are, what can we call them, formless forms? They are forms nonetheless. In a way, the whole universe is a form, as subtle as it may become from our perspective. So the form side of existence is no longer needed as we understand and utilize it as a medium of experience. So let's just say the Antikorana built to the spiritual triad indicates that the fourth initiation is nigh, is about to be achieved, and that the solar angel can discontinue its supervision and that that form that we call the egoic body or the sheath of the ego can be dispensed with. The man then, the man enters into the consciousness of the monad, the one. We have to stop imagining that the monad is some little point as if on a chart. It's a state of the awareness of oneness and identification as oneness, which I can only think increasingly intensifies as evolution proceeds. Sometimes there is the impression that all that can be achieved in terms of consciousness can be achieved by man, but I think that's a serious mistake. And that the higher we ascend along, retracting along the emanative stream, as it were, the more intense, the more vivid will become our realization of the one and of ourselves as the one. The causal body disintegrates, the personality fades out, and illusion is ended. And I want to say at least this phase of illusion, because he has said that up until the ninth initiation, there is not the ending of illusion, and now we're only talking about the fourth initiation, as far ahead of us as it may exist. And from a certain perspective, compared to those infinite and absolute states that are post and pre-universal, even the universe is illusion, the greatest of all illusions, and simply a partiality of absolute infinitude. I know I'm throwing in some philosophy here, but I don't find a way somehow in my psyche to avoid it, because it gives the biggest picture. And we do need that big picture to put things into proportion. So finally, after all of these, after the egoic body, causal body, solar angel, or let's just say its projection into the higher mental plane, have served their purpose, we enter into the consciousness of one. And I want to say not immediately, because various states of triadal consciousness, various states of triadal consciousness have to be lived through. The man becomes detached from any causal body, it's gone. But he lives in his organized Buddhic vehicle, and then he lives in his organized atomic vehicle. He lives, man lives within the personality of the monad before living in the monad per se. It's a bit like, there's an analogy here. We live in our personality before we focus our consciousness and the sense of being entirely within the causal body. And we live within the spiritual triad considered as the personality of the monad before we, at the sixth initiation, have achieved the ability to live within the monad in its entirety. And so we become eventually a monadically infused spiritual triad. We become a monadically infused spiritual triad, just as we were before a soul infused personality. Okay, soul infused personality. So I think we can see the ascending process, and those masters who are not yet Shohans are increasingly monadically infused spiritual triads, just as we move towards the fourth initiation, are increasingly soul-infused personalities. Anyway, for man, anyway, this is the consummation of the great work, and another Son of God has entered into the Father's home. He knows he is the monad. He experiences his being as the monad. Okay. Well, we're talking about things that lie ahead of us, okay? But maybe now and then we can get a faint impression, a glimpse of those higher inclusive, homogeneous, unified states towards which consciousness and the sense of being tend. That he may go out from there into the world of phenomena in order to work with the plan is probable. But he will not need to undergo the processes of manifestation as humanity does. Here's where we have, you know, the situation of the Christ going out to work with humanity on the outer plane, but not having to, as the Christ, go through the experience of birth and growing up, birth in a physical form, and the maturing of the physical form. I think from the, as I gather it, from the time a disciple has achieved the second initiation and the opening of the sixth petal, he can serve as a host to one of these incoming higher beings who, under the law of economy, do not waste time in being born in the normal way and growing up in the normal way, but can use a prepared disciple to overshadow or even to take possession of the vehicles of that disciple. So anyway, he can then construct for the work his own body, his body of expression. That's another way of doing it. The Mayava Rupa. And he doesn't have to be born to do that in the, so, okay. I would say this then, perhaps. PH. No, that's not it. Perhaps the creation of a Maya Virupa is the preferred. Preferred method of manifestation of a master or Shohan, and maybe even an initiate of the fourth degree can do so. He can work through and with energy as the plan dictates. Notice these last words, where they hold the key to manifestation. In other words, what these great souls will attempt to manifest depends entirely upon the phase of the divine plan which must appear, appear at that time. Our study of the energies which have been brought to our attention as we studied Rule 10 has brought us to a consideration of, and now DK is going to give us, I think, a summary here. I mean, you know, these are, let's face it, friends, these are heavy, ponderous tomes, and a lifetime of study. Well, I've been studying this material for over 50 years, and the Alice Bailey material specifically for 47 years, and I feel, and I think rightly feel, that I'm just scratching the surface in my understanding. But we have to get that understanding into the very limited and limiting brain consciousness. And that in itself is part of the redemptive work. So we will just proceed the best we can. And the time that it takes, but things are at this time for all of us speeding up if we are attentive and diligent. So we've come to the consideration of personality emanating from the coordinated man, and another way to call this is the let's just say get the vehicles to work together without too much friction. Then dominant human beings, there's always that Leonian phase, probably occurring within the fifth petal, where the lower sense of identity, the little personal self, looms so large, and its method of dealing with the world is to insist on its own personal will. And then groups also have personalities, but they are entirely redeemed personalities. You know, ashramic groups, the hierarchy of adepts, they have their extensions through which their higher nature expresses. We can call that a kind of group personality. That's one thing. And then the integrating group of mystics of the New Age, and we call this often the new group of world servers. They all have their personalities, but the question is, when personality is demonstrated, is it under the infusion, pervasion of the soul and higher centers of power? Is it? And I'm sure that many of us run into conflicts where we have to choose between the higher impulse and what something pulling earthward seems within us seems to want. So this will be an important consideration for this group of mystics, is gaining each year in potency. And let's just say they are practical mystics of the Aquarian type. So that's the difference, really. Not those who want to run away from the world, shun the world, find the world objectionable and limiting, and do not want to give their attention to the redeeming of the world, which they consider, I think, largely irredeemable. In a way, some of the interpretations of Christianity have done away with the necessity of working at all on the redemption of the world, because it's basically all going to disappear with the second coming of Christ, the Armageddon, the second coming of Christ, and the rapture, and all these many, many things. It's a great escape, and It's not a seventh-ray heaven-to-earth model, which we are now enjoined to follow. Okay. Now, so we had personality energy, either a high form of energy or a type of energy which conflicts with the spiritual energy. We do have now, in a still larger context, although in a way I'm sure planets have their personalities too, we have the, I think it would be useful. Planetary energies. You know, right here, it's where the thinking people who are intelligent but still rather more materialistic in their awareness, this is where they draw the line. You know, how can those spherical, those great balls of dirt, rock, mineral kingdom have anything to do with what we are? You know, the existence of the subtle energies escapes them. So we have the seven planets, and I suppose, since we do have many more, this means principally the sacred planets. We have the Earth, which is our center, our home, and the chakra within the solar logos, for which we are increasingly responsible. Eventually, this Earth being, also with our help, and of course with the intention of the ensouling spirit of the Earth. This time I'm not talking about the planetary entity, I'm talking about the great being, the planetary logos, which the intention of the planetary logos will shape into a sacred planet. And then we have the moon, also part of the Earth really, but the scene of planetary and systemic failure, which has a backward draw upon the would-be advancing life. So what can be said here in this summary? Only a few things can be noted about this section of energies and about the next, for this is a series of instructions for the aspirant, and not a treatise on energy, perhaps a treatise on cosmic fire was the treatise on energy, and also as the book Esoteric Astrology. Yet to be written at this point, when a treatise on white magic was being written. But, you know, we're going to get into some pretty deep astrological considerations in this book, kind of a foreshadowing of the book to come, a great treatise on energy. And he called it his most occult book because it dealt only with energies. So those are the planetary energies, and we do work with them, and we are aware of their cycles, of their revolutionary periods, of the astrological implications, and so forth. And well, we do work with these, but we can only work with them to a degree, and the masters of the wisdom are able much more to function in relation to them. Now we have another category, or as he calls these things, section of energies, section. So we're looking at different sections of energies. And now the solar energies. I guess Master DK is telling us the same thing from many different perspectives, and we will thus learn to recognize these factors in various contexts. The physical sun, I suppose this would be including latent fire, and also that's the denser type of fire, fire by friction, and radiatory fire. So basically, physical solar fire and etheric solar fire. Not yet, really, not yet solar fire as we are inclined to think of it in relation to the soul. And then cosmic sources, solar energies coming from cosmic sources. Notice the contrast there. We have solar energies coming from cosmic sources. Now, in a way, if we go beyond the dense physical and etheric vehicles of the solar logos, we are into that which could be called cosmic, the cosmic planes, you know. A solar system only exists in the way that DK describes it, as evidence of the etheric and physical aspects of the solar logos. Once we get into the cosmic astral body, the cosmic mental body of the solar logos, we are into cosmic sources. See, we have to look at what really is a cosmic source. When you think that the causal body of even our planetary logoi is are on the cosmic mental plane, they are cosmic sources too. They're called planetary, they're called solar, but sometimes they are called cosmic beings. And the solar logos is from one perspective a supervising systemic being, but from another perspective a cosmic being whose causal body is on the first subplane of the cosmic mental plane. You know, we're using words here, of course, for states of being which are really inconceivable to us in anywhere near their true state, and we do not know whether they are prakritic or not. The smallest unit, apparently, on our cosmic physical plane is called the bubble in the koilon. Is it divisible? And if it is it composed of many still more refined types of atoms or particles or material units? You know, that's way beyond us, of course. But the question of whether the cosmic planes are prakritic or not is a serious question. So anyway, cosmic sources. And with these cosmic sources, you know, we have cosmic logoi, but they are composed of solar logoi and their expressive suns. And when you look at it, even the supercosmic logoi, such as the one about whom naught may be said, have as their visible constituents solar logoi and their aggregates of solar logoi, which are constellational chakras within the one about whom not may be said within a supercosmic logos. You know, just check out page 293 of a treatise on cosmic fire, and we have the unknown there. That is a supercosmic logos. Well, you know, it is a little bit satisfying to be able to conceptualize some of these greater beings and their manifestations, but really we're still on our own mental plane as we're doing so. And we're not experiencing such energies, of course not. We can barely experience in a conscious and sustained way the energies of the causal body, yet alone the spiritual triad. So we have a long way to go here, but at least we are more certain of the path we are taking. So, you know, we're in this section here where we're discussing a review. Our study of the energies has brought us to the place where we are considering planetary energy, well, personality energies, planetary energies, solar energies, and cosmic energies. Okay. In all thoughts concerning these energies, it should be remembered that they are passed to us through, or rather constitute the bodies of, certain lives whom we call devas in their greater and lesser groups, and are therefore and that therefore we are all the time working in the bodies of lives. So when working in bodies, we are working within the Deva kingdom, the bodies of lives, and hence we are influencing them. So some of these greater beings, you know, they are as much Deva as they are man, as much man as they are Deva. They are called the heavenly man, the grand heavenly man, you know, and I suppose for cosmic logo and those beyond, some other kind of man appellation can be applied, but at the same time, their means of expression are very devic. In one way, when you think about man, you can equate it with spirit. When you think about deva, you can equate it with matter, but of course, these devas, they do have their own monadic spirit aspect. Everything does. Just they play a different and receptive role, part of the universal duality of spirit and matter. So in all these thoughts concerning these energies, it should be remembered that they are passed to us through, or rather, constitute the bodies of certain lives whom we call devas. So the body nature and the ray nature, you might almost say, these two types of nature are devic. When I think of going from here to there, you know, reaching across a chasm and going from one point of concentration to another, it requires a being that can span those two points, and that spanning function, that connecting function, is particularly applying to the devas. What we call man is a more concentrated source, and devas are more elastic in perceptual space. So, you know, when we want to reach, putting it in simple language, from one thing to another, we require the devic connection. Some of you, therefore, who have made a study of a treatise on cosmic fire may find it of value to note the following items of information. Well, we can make a study of it, but you know, this is a book intended in its depths only for initiates. And when we get into the rays and initiations and the 14 rules for group initiation, it's another initiatic presentation, really, which we have to transpose to our own level. It's just the depth of Master DK's mind is astonishing, and of course he's just presenting to us what to him are only the ABCs. So we're going to note the following. If we have studied. Number one, the lowest type of devas or builders on the evolutionary path are the violet devas. Now, these are particularly associated with the etheric plane. And, you know, we have these general categories there, the violet, they're sort of the third down, the purple is the lowest of the four, then the violet, then the light violet, and then the lavender. They are the highest of these, of this category of violet devas. Then come the green, and you know, if we say, do they have much to do with the astral plane? Because there are said to be certain great, what can I call them, medical devas who are or will be, who are cooperating or will be cooperating with man in healing enterprises. And we do have to remember that the color green is associated in part with the solar plexus, which is the chakra which rules the astral body. So there's a rose color there, and there's a green color in the solar plexus chakra, and green associated somewhat with the third ray, you know, half of six. Green has to do with vitalization and the sort of a natural health. So when you want to restore vitality to a being and get them to, you know, spring again, some of the healers use what's called spring green, you know, the color of the new shoots. That will be a fourth method of healing, and one of the earliest to be brought forward, color and sound. So green, I think, has its place in relation to the astral body. Some people say that they just count the spectrum as it normally appears, and then the heart takes on the color green, the heart center, but it seems that that is not the color given by the Tibetan, although there is a vitalization factor within the heart. And hence, the color green may be somewhat appropriate, but he does give the golden color when he's talking about the color of that heart chakra, as Leadbeater does as well. So, and last of all, the white devas. You know, this is interesting. among which can be found the, let's call it the guardian angels of the human being. And these are all dominated by a fourth and special group. These control the exoteric processes of physical plane existence. And what is the color or nature of this special group? We don't know. And we don't even know if it's justified to be rising through the planes as we change colors, but it seems to be, and yet all of these have an effect upon the physical plane. You know, our study of the devas will be well correlated with the Aquarian energy. Something about Aquarius, astrologers who study it have told me, you know, and aviation. Interesting, you know, that Lindbergh, Charles Lindbergh, was an Aquarian. It's associated with invention, action through space at a distance. It's associated with being in the air and the wings that it takes to be in the air. And for that reason, the Aquarian age will be an appropriate time to study the subtle winged beings. I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of development within the bird evolution, which DK does not include directly with animals, he says it's purer type of evolution, will be attended to during the Aquarian age, a time when the bird group flourishes. Just a speculation. What can you do? You know, you can speculate, and then you can watch and see whether there was reason to your speculation or whether it was a bit wild. Okay, the next thing. It must not be forgotten, however, that on a lower scale of the evolutionary ladder are other lives wrongly entitled devas, which work in obedience to the law and which are controlled by the higher entities. Now, this is a very important point. In other words, basically he's saying here that we wrongly call the elementals by the name devas, when in fact they are very unconscious. I suppose there are unconscious devas as well. They have not reached the individualized state. But in general, the term deva applies to a higher form of life than elementals. There seems to be kind of a crossover here, but as he says, wrongly entitled. So he himself seems to do it at times, but here he's being very, very clear about these elemental beings. There's the tendency there, you know, for man to be able to command the elementals, but with certain devas he must cooperate, and others with other devas, in relation to other devas, man must obey. He certainly doesn't obey the elementals. There are, for instance, denser forms of gaseous life, termed often salamanders, and here, let's say, related, I don't know why that doesn't work for me, related to fire, salamanders, the elements of fire, right? If I would just read ahead a little bit, I would see that I'm putting down exactly what DK has already written. Okay, there are, and this is related to the gaseous life, the third sublevel from below. These are directly under the control of Lord Agni, Lord of the mental plane. And of course, there are different Agnis. You know, there are systemic Agnis, Agni, and cosmic Agni, representing the personality of the solar logos. These are directly controlled under the Lord Agni, Lord of the Mental Plane. And in this mental age, Aquarius bringing in the fifth ray, we have the element of fire entering into the mechanics of living as never before. We have, you know, the thing that has changed our lives, the internal combustion engine. And, of course, all of the developments upon that, the atomic developments and the augmentation of fiery energy with the energy of the atom being released. So we have the element of entering as never before. Well, I mean, you know, it used to be horsepower, right? And now it's these amazingly powerful engines that drive our cars and even our airplanes and so forth. Eliminate the products which are controlled by heat, and you will bring our civilization to a stop. You will bring all means of transportation to an end and all modes of lighting. You would throw all manufactories into the discard. Basically, again, these fiery lives are found in all that burns and in the warmth that holds the all life formation on earth and causes the flourishing of all living things. So this type of fire not only drives the mechanisms on which our present civilization is based, but also holds living forms intact through latent heat, largely latent and radiatory fire. So this is a fiery age, and already with the coming of the Master R, as Sir Francis Bacon, you know, and the age of scientific investigation was beginning, and this was back in the very early 17th century. And he, as they say, he rang the bell, which called the wits together, the intelligent human beings who began to investigate the nature of nature. So many things were discovered along the line of fire, you know, he being such an Aquarian, and Aquarius having to do with many types of fire, with the hidden but powerful energies which drive things forward, even though it's not a fire sign. But we certainly have discovered atomic fire under the age of Aquarius, or at least as much into the age of Aquarius that we have ventured. This is a discovery of the Aquarian age, atomic energy. There's been a slow overlap since the time of Bacon, and maybe we will be quite finished with the Piscean age in the earlier part of the 22nd century. So, under the law of correspondences, the mental plane has an analogy in the third subplane of the physical plane, the plane into which science is now entering. Do we mean the 33rd from above? Mind has for its main expression in the material world what we call our scientific civilization. Well, the gaseous plane is third from the bottom, and the super etheric level is third from the top of the etheric physical systemic plane. And we're certainly entering the fourth ether, and maybe to an extent the third ether, but beyond that we have an occult situation. Always the first two subplanes of any plane are considered very esoteric and truly occult, and maybe are not entered quite so easily. So under the law of correspondence is the mental plane, it's third from below, you know, corresponding to the gaseous nature, has an analogy in the third subplane of the physical plane, the plane into which science is now entering. Well, is that the gaseous subplane? To a degree. But also science is entering the etheric levels. Was it doing so at the time this book was written? Well, maybe to an extent. The atomic bomb had not yet been created, nor was it exploded until 10, 11, 12 years, 15 years later. But still, we were entering an age in which fire and heat were very important, and fire and heat of a new kind. Well, look, friends, this is the end of 1 hour of our work. So let's just say that 1 hour has passed, but I'm going to go on as the possibility of driving forward and finishing quite a bit of this book stands before me, and I would really like to do that, if possible. Then the two extremely weighty tomes, Treatise on Cosmic Fire, and a treatise on white magic will have been, well, at least superficially covered. And the Raised and Initiations, another very weighty tome that has been completed both in written and partially in audio form or video form. Okay. So now we're dealing with fire, and we're moving on. Agni rules the mental plane and has domination likewise on the third subplane of the etheric planes. Right. So, interesting. And this means domination on the super etheric plane and on the atmic plane, if we get into the sort of higher ethers, the cosmic ethers, and we count down, we will find that the super etheric plane and Agni, super etheric plane and Atma correspond, and Agni will be an important ruler there. He is the lord of the fifth or mental plane, counting from above downwards, if one must employ these terms for the sake of symbolism. Of course, they're not the true thing, but they do give us a way of focusing our mind. For this world cycle, the Agni has so much to do with the Aryan age, doesn't it? It's an age of fire, an age of the fifth ray, and therefore counting from above down, the mental plane, counting from below up, the atmic plane, will and mind. Will and mind together will be representative of the Aryan age in which we still find ourselves, even though in the overlapping, the sixth root race is not far from beginning. If one must employ these terms, for this world cycle, Agni is the dominating influence. Now, is that a round or is that a root race? If it's a world cycle, it seems more like a round, but does this mean a round? That's the question. So, yes. Agni dominates, certainly dominates in the fifth root race, but we're not yet into the fifth round. And Varuna had lots to do with this fourth round, and certainly with the Atlantean civilization. There was much of, well, Agni, in a way, as it relates to the fifth ray, coming in with the individualization of man in Lemurian times. So for this world cycle, and you know, those are ambiguous words. A world cycle can be a chain round, and it can be a scheme round, and it can be maybe the duration of a root race. So does this mean round, or the duration round, or the duration of a root race? Well, not sure, because that's the way of blinding things. Don't be too specific, and then let the student supply his own interpretation. Agni is the dominating influence, and I would say especially, okay, during the fifth root race, though Indra, lord of the Buddhic or intuitional levels, and interestingly, also a storm god. That is interesting. Thunder and lightning, of course, with the second ray, the symbol is the thunder, the word which cycles down the ages, and lightning, the symbol is the first ray, and maybe kind of being in the middle of everything, there's a combination of first and second rays with the Buddhic plane. But eventually Indra, lord of the Buddhic or intuitional level, has a subtle control which is steadily waxing stronger and will dominate during the sixth root race, which eventually will be an intuitional root race. All humanity is striving towards the fourth plane of union. You know, this is the plane on which our monads are not originating but are expressing. All humanity is striving towards the fourth plane of union between the higher and the lower three, but at this present moment, the plane of mind or of fire is most important. So our job is to blend the concrete mind with the abstract mind, and then the concrete mind, abstract mind with the transcendental mind of Buddhi. That's our task, and then we will have Buddhi Manas. And the question is our thinking formulation fertilized by Buddhi? And that's, and if it is, we will know more and more about what the divine plan really is. So we need to remember that just as in particular incarnations, men are focused or polarized in various bodies, depending on the sounding of the notes of the causal body that the solar angel engineers to sound forth before every incarnation. So different incarnations will have different emphases according to what has to be built in or supplemented. And probably we already have an idea about some of our deficiencies which need to be built. Many people have a mental deficiency. DK says a lot of mystically inclined disciples don't have as much fifth ray as they need, and so the solar angel sounds forth the note, or engineers the sounding forth of the note of the causal body, and may choose maybe a fifth-ray personality. You find this information in the early part of Letters on Occult Meditation, where it talks about the kinds of meditations to be brought forward for the man's work. So the fifth-ray personality may be chosen, okay, and we don't know yet. But we do know we have deficiencies. Many people who are on the sixth ray and maybe given way to the second ray, they don't have as practical an approach to the concretions of life as those who are on the 1, 3, 5, 7 lines. So as a ray of personality or mind, one of the concrete rays has to be chosen for however long to help build in those additional abilities which have not been along the line of least resistance. Right, what have we been doing here? It's a question of forest and the trees. It's easy to get lost in the trees here. So violet devas, elementals, and I think here this should be somehow this should be set a numbering value of 3, I think. Yep. Okay. So under the law of correspondences, the mental plane has an analogy to the third subplane of the physical plane. From below, I guess. The plane into which science is now entering, a mind has for its main expression the material world. Right. Okay. We looked at that earlier, and now we're on number. I just want to get the list straight here. So we know DK talks about so many things that we have to keep our lists in order. So we know what every tabulation contains. So we want to note these things. The lowest are the violet devas. I'm just kind of making a little summary here. And elementals must work in obedience to the higher entities. And the third subplane of the physical plane is analogous under the law of correspondence, the mental plane, is analogous to the mental plane. So let's just say here, I'll make a little statement, and I'll say that the, sorry for the slight delay here, that in a way, the mental plane is analogous to the third ether, and that Agni rules the mental plane and also dominates the third ether, which is the fifth plane from below. Now, we go on. He says these are things we should note, right? But to hold all this in our mind, well, it's nigh unto impossible. Can be done, I suppose. These items of information are things we have to correlate. Then number 5, we need to remember that just as in particular incarnations men are focused or polarized in various bodies, sometimes the astral, sometimes the mental, depending upon how to keep the balance. So at this time, one might infer that our planetary logos is focused in his mental body. Well, he has not achieved the second cosmic initiation yet. He has not yet achieved the second cosmic initiation. Uh-huh. Now, this is interesting. He has not achieved the second cosmic initiation, but remember that an illumined mind and spiritual intelligence is required of man in order to take the second initiation. So maybe something analogous is going on there for the planetary logos, but he fills in something here that may be amplifying of what is given in Treatise on Cosmic Fire. It has been said, is striving towards the fourth cosmic initiation, which makes possible our attainment of the fourth initiation in general, but not yet, for he carries us forward with him, and on our particular level, we achieve as the cells in his body. Well, this is interesting because he has not yet achieved the fourth initiation in the series of seven, and the second cosmic initiation is not yet his. So it's a long way before he can achieve the fourth cosmic, but through our chain, he achieves a type of fourth initiation, and as cells, we are carried along with him. Now, here's the question. It is not yet decided or established whether our solar logos will take the fourth cosmic initiation or the fifth in this solar system. And our Earth is the base of the spine center, which is activated to the fullest extent at the fifth initiation. So, if we take only the fourth cosmic initiation, the planetary logos, can the solar logos take the fifth cosmic initiation, or is he simply limited then to the fourth cosmic initiation in this solar system? So, you see, even for these great beings, the question of timing is a question of how well they do. Now, if we on our planet would achieve the fifth cosmic initiation in terms of the planetary stream of initiations, then it would be more likely that the solar logos could also achieve the fifth and begin in the next or first ray solar system with the work on the sixth cosmic initiation rather than on the fifth. Well, as I say, these are words based upon some kind of mental understanding or mental correlation. Energetically, we cannot at all experience what these words indicate. So he, it has been said, is striving towards the fourth cosmic initiation. But our attainment of the fourth initiation, unless it's all of humanity, but the attainment of a good number of people, okay, I'll put it here. The attainment of the fourth initiation by a large number of people can also be facilitated by the planetary logos taking the fourth in a series of seven lesser initiations. So go to page 384 in A Treatise on Cosmic Fire. These are big matters, and our time scales at the present time are so dwarfed, at least if we look at the kinds of very enduring, huge time scales that the ageless wisdom presents to us. I mean, science is telling us that maybe our solar system, of course, it only considers it from the outer level, will last some 15 billion years, and occultism and the Hindu chronology, or Brahmanical chronology, tells us of 311 trillion and 40 billion years. That's a huge difference. And if we were to knock off the last six zeros, we would still have the duration of our solar system still, well, would still be some 314. But approximately 340 million times longer than science is presently estimating. But we have to remember that we're also considering inner life and inner cycles with the occult methods. Now, what I'm going to do is shoot over here to this Treatise on Cosmic Fire, page 39. Oh, 311. Now I got it. 311 and 40 billion, 311, not 340 or 300 and that's it. So just take a look at that, if I can find it here. This is number 5, and are we on page 39? Let's take a look at the hidden, there it is. Okay, so it's either on page 40 or it's on page 39 of A Treatise on Cosmic Fire. And there it is. Okay. And we could make that very big, you know, and find out that the duration of the solar system on both inner and outer levels, goes to 311 trillion, 40 billion years. Now, something's wrong here, of course, the way it's written. This is 3 trillion. But 100 of such years, you see, it was not successfully multiplied by 100, and so we do have kind of a mistake there. But if we multiply by 100, we add a couple of zeros, and then there would be 1, 2, 4, 10 zeros. Anyway, it comes out 311 trillion 40 billion. I never noticed that mistake before in the transference, and it would not be found in the books, I hope, I think. Okay. But that just shows you, you know, when you go through these books meticulously, you do find things. Misspellings and misrepresentations and old chains of glamour snap. And we have old chains of clamor, something like that. Snap, something like that. So there are mistakes here. And the readers, careful readers of the books, will note them. Okay. So 1 year of Brahma's age is 3 trillion, 110 billion, 400 million years. Add a couple of zeros and you get 311 trillion, 40 billion years. Well, little discoveries are important. Now, going on. Go to page. All right, I'm just giving you a little respite as I slow down here, right? Now, we're going on. These are important things to note, he says. As time progresses, Indra will swing into control and the age of air will be ushered in. Already, travel has shifted from the sea to the air. And I want to just say, of course, international travel has shifted from the sea to the air. Just think of it, you know, 100 years ago, it's just the beginning with Lindbergh, but you weren't going to be crossing the oceans in big airplanes. It was big ships that did that. So, but the air, of course, is the Buddhic plane. So God is the air. The god Indra is the next god in line for development. The god Indra is next for development in the human consciousness and psyche. More and more, as the Buddhic principle manifests and the at-one-ment is achieved, and we want to say with the, is achieved with the coming in of the fourth ray from its monadic aspect. We shall see this age of air coming into being. Now, you know, the Tibetan is writing in the 1930s and here, and he certainly would have been able to anticipate the kinds of travel, the kinds of communication, the wireless and all of its extensions, the radio and all of its extensions. All of that is very Aquarian. More and more as the Buddhic principle manifests and at-one-ment is achieved. So remember, the Buddhic plane is the plane of at-one-ment, the first such plane. Other planes, too, are planes of at-one-ment. Monadic plane certainly is. And as we ascend higher, the oneness is simply perceived and assumed. We shall see the age of air coming into being. A corroboration of this can be seen in the gradual control by men of the air. Amazing, you know, when you look at the, what's it called, those magnificent men and their flying machines at the very beginning of the century, those flimsy little aircraft, and you were lucky to get off the ground and lucky to land alive. But that was the beginning of our mastery of the air. Uranus was coming in. It was a liberation from gravity, you might say. That Lord of Liberation, which is ruled by Uranus, liberty. Liberty, equality, fraternity. So the Liberty Lord came in first, liberating us from gravitation, bringing Uranus strongly into effect and changing the traditional way of moving and of communicating. A corroboration of this is seen by our gradual control by men of the air. And of course, what we have now is just amazing. You see some of the anticipated airplanes that take you from China to America in 4 or 5 hours. You know, it's leaving the Concorde behind. In an esoteric sense, all in the future will become lighter, more rarefied and more etherealized. That's the word I'm looking for. We are dealing with the etherealization. Etherealization of matter. And I'm choosing my words with care. So what is the effect upon dense matter when, let's just say, our question is here, when etheric matter acts upon dense physical matter, what is the effect upon dense physical matter? Well, maybe, simplification is one of the effects of etherealization, and we have now matter ascending to the point where it becomes radioactive, just as any being can demonstrate radioactivity, and make that transition into the next and higher kingdom. Radioactive man is man preparing to enter the fifth kingdom. And the radioactive animal is preparing to enter the fourth, and so it goes. He says these are very obscure forms of life as they become radioactive, maybe especially in the plant kingdom and so forth. But he talks about that in the Treatise on Cosmic Fire, that radioactivity is a climactic state and not a state which is constantly degenerating. Through the half-life process, to building up towards radioactivity. So levitation, we've seen people levitate, we've seen videos of that, and not with hocus pocus, but the real thing, even though it may not be spirituality, it certainly is occultism. Man is rising, more rarefied and more etherealized. So the age of air and the lightness of man will be ushered in, and I imagine still smaller bodies and lighter bodies. And when you're walking on the moon, it's a lot easier than walking on Earth. And we can, they say the Tibetan monks have these methods of covering vast tracts of space by levitating somewhat above the ground and then really going. How they do that, I don't know, but levitation is a possibility, and locomotion in a levitated state is also possible. I think I'll put that down. Locomotion in a levitated state is traditionally possible in Tibet, where the secret methods are known. But of course, these methods cannot be released to humanity just yet because the danger of misuse by amoral man is ever present, and we certainly haven't overcome our amorality or lack of morality. Now, number seven, these are all factors we should know about. Our God is a consuming fire refers primarily to agni, the controlling factor in this age, this Aryan age. Well, also, if you're talking about the consuming fire of love, the whole soul of Logos is that. There are different forms of agni. One form of agni, as we have seen, is the personality and nature of the soul of Logos. It is a great Devic life, but subsidiary to the soul of Logos per se, whose causal body is higher than the realms that agni rules. But then when you think of cosmic planes and super cosmic planes and super super cosmic planes, and on it goes until DK tells us 10 dimensions. Well, then, what is the ultimate agni? Or the ultimate, I mean, in the names that we use anyway. The ultimate Varuna. Well, maybe it's not called that at all, but there's going to be rulers of the different cosmic levels. And they will be vast. But they are probably, beyond even the ken of our soul of Logos. Who maybe, I guess, even as a crystal is, or maybe even a molecule or an atom, compared with some super lives in the great emanatory stream of our universal logos. So we have plenty to keep us busy, plenty of interest, plenty of unfoldment, and yet it's all within an infinitesimal compared to the infinity which we are. Our God is a consuming fire. refers primarily to Agni, the controlling factor in this age. So it's coming forward, you know, what is approaching is the high development of the fire of mind. It's already quite highly developed, but abstract mind and transcendental mind need much to be developed. Okay, DV. Developed. Now, certainly DV, PD. Okay, we'll develop. Sorry for the pause. Just trying to make the way ahead more efficient as there is much to do ahead. DVPD. The devas of the fire will play an increasingly important part in all earth processes. You know, their time has come. What should we say, the devas of the waters, had their time during the Atlantean floods, of which there were a number, HPB tells us, not just one. To them, these devas of the fire, you know, is given the work of inaugurating the new age. It is said that Aries of the zodiacal signs is the sign which initiates, impels, brings in the new age of Aquarius, the new world and civilization and the new continent. Well, what will that be? This is probably not Pacifica arising in the midst of the Pacific Ocean. Probably not that. Maybe this is a new continental emphasis. But the new age, of course, is Aquarian, and there will be changes, earth changes. But it probably is not. The last great transition was governed by Varuna, yeah. Okay, well, that was maybe the transition from the age of water. Well, let's just put it in different terms. From the Atlantean age to the Aryan age. Probably that. But South America will again become very important in the sixth root race age. Now, that sixth root race is going to last a long time. DK tells us 10 million years. And our Aryan race, or root race, has only been going for a million or maybe a little more. So already it's beginning, maybe by the time we finish with the age of Capricorn, in another 2,000, 2,500 years, this sixth root race will be entering. But right now we're entering into the sixth sub-race of the fifth root race to develop the abstract mind, whereas during the sixth root race, per se, it'll be the intuition, per se. Okay, well, the great cycles control, and this is all in the timing of our planetary logos, who is taking it in a way from the timing of the solar logos and so forth, who's beating the drum here, but, you know, the superior beings listen to their superiors and try to correlate their timing with the schedule of their superiors. Okay, a little more. A little more, a little more. Agni controls not only the fires of the earth and rules the mental plane, but he is definitely associated with the work of arousing the sacred fire of Kundalini. So Agni is involved in the, you know, the fire of matter as well. Let's see. So Agni is involved in stimulating the rising or uprising of the latent fires of matter called Kundalini, called when they, well, just called Kundalini, that's all. Okay. Well, that fits because mind and matter go well together, and this is an age when the mental aspect of Pluto and the control from the fifth ray Ajna center dealing with the rising at the base of the spine, which rising is ruled by Mercury, which is a quintessentially fifth ray planet with a higher, still higher third ray. I, as you know, I theorize two monadic rays for every planet. One is more of a subray, and that's the fifth subray, but finally the ultimate third ray of matter. Okay, a lot of associations right in there. But the fifth ray is very important in this uprising of the Kundalini, and only when there is a really illuminated mind, illumined mind, and a very strong will and a powerful imagination can that Ajna center be used, a well-developed head center, can that Ajna center be used to see to the rising of Kundalini from the base to the crown by the appropriate geometrical pattern. Right. Well, there's a lot here to learn. Okay, so let's highlight this as well. We're told that the third ray monads, maybe the essentially third ray monads, will achieve during this fifth root race. And I suppose the second ray monads during this, the sixth root race, and the first ray monads, some of them, always some of them, will achieve during the seventh root race. Well, there's a smaller achievement ahead of a greater achievement because, you know, remember we're going to be moving into a planetary logoic focus in the fifth chain, sixth chain, seventh chain. I don't know if we're going to be like Venus, where five scheme rounds seem to have been enough to bring Venus to the full and desired development, with Earth intended to have been developing at the same rate. Maybe we'll have to see through the whole development through seven, and then still more achievement will be found. But probably a lot of moonchain monads now and monads from the earlier solar system who have the very strong fundamental third ray will achieve in this Aryan age. What does achievement mean? Probably the taking of the fourth initiation and the real entry into the kingdom of souls. That's probably what achievement at this time will mean. I'm not going to call it the ninth initiation or something like that. So, the work of the sacred fire, right. Note how the correspondence works out. A great part of the fifth root race, three-fifths perhaps, stand at the close of the probationary path, and with the coming in of the new age and the advent of the Christ in due time and in his own place. So he's saying, you know, don't get ahead of the game and say, search for him in London. You know, people are impatient and want to have the distinction of having been first to spot the Christ as if it was some kind of bird watching, you know. So the advent of the Christ in due time and in his own place, note the care with which I express this dogmatic assertions in terms of men's concrete mind are inadvisable. Many will find it possible to make the adequate extra effort entailed in the taking of the first major initiation. And here, does he mean the planetary third initiation? They will begin to pass from the fifth to the fourth plane. Yes, so it must be. So indeed, it's always that way. So indeed, we will have the third initiation coming in soon for many, or for some. And I think in the age of Capricorn, let's just round it off and call it 2,500 years ahead, there'll be a lot of that third initiation being achieved, even though Aquarius is also a sign in which the third initiation can be taken. So they will begin to pass from the fifth to the fourth plane, which means they're preparing for the fourth initiation, because the fourth ray, fourth plane, Buddhic energy is that which is the destination of the fourth degree initiates, and the increasing access to Buddhi is what brings it on, a greater love than can be contained within the causal body. So the Lord of Fire will achieve his peculiar work for this cycle by arousing the fire of Kundalini in large numbers of those who are ready. So that's clearly the responsibility of Agni to help raise Kundalini in a large group of those ready. This will begin in this century, so 20th century, and carried forward actively for the next 1,000 years during, so how should we look at that? So during the Deccan, the Deccan of Saturn and the first part of the Deccan of Mercury. Well, every one of those decanate periods in Aquarius is going to last some 720 years approximately. Yes, and then we will have the transit into the age of Capricorn after three of those periods. But, you know, given that this was written in the early part of the 20th century and it wouldn't be until 200 years ahead that the real, in 2117, let's say, that the real age of Aquarius would begin, and given that that age is 2160 and add 200 to it, so you get 2360. So add 200 to 720, you get almost 1,000 years. So maybe not much of the age of Mercury, the second decan, will be involved in that rising of Kundalini, but Mercury does rule Kundalini active and Mars Kundalini latent. So maybe Mercury will carry things on and up as it begins its own decanate rulership. It's out of little things, you know, that he said that you have to piece together what the activities will be during these various decanates. But of course, we just have that steady growth ahead of us. And that can only be done in a careful and fairly laborious manner. Okay, in your work, you may later be shown, all depends upon your aptitude, methods of approach to these dominating forces, but this will come subjectively and not through magical work and formulas. You know, so many would-be magicians are just really anxious to get a hold of the magical words and just start doing things, making things happen. But, you know, the real growth is just happening very silently internally, and suddenly something lifts and you see what wasn't there before, and that's where the real expansion of consciousness is occurring, and not through the outer repetition of certain formulas about which the repeater knows so very little anyway. The attainment of a right vibration will work automatically in the production of right conditions and right rapports. So we've just been through some sections here where he tells us what's happening and what we need to note. We have to come in rapport with the Deva Kingdom, and it's going to be involved in transmitting energy, and certain kinds of energies of which we have no present idea are going to be transmitted and bring about a unification which we can barely conceive at this point, given all of the disturbance arising from the great heresy of separatism or separateness. So we have to know about the violet devas and their effect upon the growing access to the etheric plane, systemic etheric. And there's a violet subcolor involving the cosmic ethers as well. So whatever the colors of those systemic planes are, you know, maybe the Buddha has something to do with some kind of cosmic purple, and the atmic with cosmic violet, and the monadic with cosmic light violet, and the sea of fire with cosmic lavender, in addition to the other colors which are there from the systemic level. And the gaseous plane and the super etheric are becoming activated already. There's been a lot of entry into the fourth etheric, the lowest etheric. And the meaning of Agni as fire will come into greater focus. And there will be variations in foci in different incarnations, depending upon what has to be balanced. I think all of evolutionary work, and we think about the solar angels, the winged heart, the sort of Libran winged heart, balance must be preserved. Otherwise, the kind of construction that you will get might be very, well, unbalanced, distorted, and short-lived. If you've got a machine and it really starts shaking, it's not in a balanced condition, and it's going to shake apart, and same with a human being. The age of air is coming. It's even more with us now than it was at the Tibetans' time. But now look, you know, I'm talking about space-based weaponry to create the dominance of the part over the whole, which shows us that the lower egoic nature of man has not been defeated. If anything, there's a danger that it may grow in the form of certain powerful individuals who just can't see beyond their own little self. I'm sure there's a story behind the inadequacies and deficiencies of any individual, and I suppose compassion can be aroused, but at the same time, the whole must be protected from the renegade or rogue part. So these are all things DK wants us to take into consideration and to understand the fire of God, the fire of Agni, but also the fire of solar fire and the fire of love. Now, in this case, there's all different ranges and categories of Agni, and what we call our normal solar fire is included in the cosmic Agni, and maybe even in the systemic Agni. So there are divisions in this great Lord, but Indra is coming in. Agni is going to work on the perfecting of many human beings through the rising of the Kundalini. So those are the factors of which Master DK wants us to take note. And now we go on. I would like to point out that we shall not waste time in planetary intricacies and the interplay of solar energies. Well, what can I say? The book, Esoteric Astrology, came along, and quite a number of discussions of planetary interrelations took place. But at least at this point, you know, DK is outlining things so that we can be true disciples and have the control of the astral body. But we'll concern ourselves with the laws of practical spiritual living. Well, you know, it's fascinating. I mean, he gets into some really cosmic things. But behind it all is his determination to make this a practical book. And maybe now and then you have to range into the cosmic area in order to give some kind of perspective to practical action or practicality, which is necessary. The practical laws, or the laws of practical spiritual living, and the laws of the soul, you know, a little bit later, were given in Esoteric Psychology 2. We want to concern ourselves with the laws of practical spiritual living. That's the whole thing. I was thinking about that, you know. Whatever circumstance you may find yourself in, you know, and there are many oppressive and disturbing and distracting circumstances, you kind of ask yourself, well, how does what I know of the teaching apply to this moment, this very moment? What does the teaching advise regarding my attitude towards this very moment? And, you know, you might have a surprising response because something in you knows more than you know. You know, the higher aspect of your nature, which is now impressing the lower, knows more than the lower knows. And when you set up the question, you're setting up an invocation, and that invocation will call forth, will evoke a response, and you'll learn something from inside yourself that you might not have learned from a book. And it's those things that really stick with us, you know, that which we come to in our own nature, rather than just have familiarized ourselves with the words of a book. So, you know, what is this moment and how does the teaching apply? See, when I ask myself that question at the moment, you know, I'm in many more mundane circumstances, and I cherish these moments when one can go over the teaching carefully. I say, well, I'm doing my best to teach and spread the knowledge of the ageless wisdom, you know. quite below the level of Master DK, but giving those associations which may bring light, or at least offering possible associations which may be light. I try to define that for myself, so I don't just, in a particular normal circumstance, rebel and say, what am I doing here? You know, why am I doing this? You know, certainly there must be something better to do. when I'm out there walking the cats, we have two new cats. It takes a while to walk these cats. It can't be trusted yet. They'll jump over the fence and be gone. What am I doing? I could say, well, I'm walking the cats and wasting my time. But, you know, I'm, on the other hand, serving the next lower kingdom, the domesticated animals, on the third and fourth ray, giving that mind, that curious cat mind, a chance to grow through the exposure of what can be found outside in the great outdoors compared with boxed up in a couple of rooms, you know. It's just serving another kingdom and also learning patience and learning how to be flexible in, you know, realizing that the teaching is everywhere. The application of the teaching can be occur under any circumstances, doing whatever. So, you know, lots of lessons to learn if we really want to apply the teaching and question ourselves as to the best way of applying the teaching. We're probably over the two-hour mark because I had one of those chronometer failures again. But, you know, I'm not going to worry too much about that. Just continue. I seek but to give a few thoughts which have relation to the coming age, and thereby enthuse us, you know, and animate us, vivify us with anticipation. And when we realize maybe how little we've done or how difficult it is, we have the conviction of the coming of a better time. I seek but to give a few thoughts which will have relation to the coming age and which will enable man to go forward to that glorious heritage which is his and into which he must inevitably enter under the good law and through the experience of rebirth. You really see how DK not only seeks to inspire us, but does inspire us. I mean, he knows what's coming in this sense. I don't mean all the details. Some of those details will be up to humanity. But the general archetype, he knows. And he calls it glorious, which is a full radiation of light and love and will power. And the law is good, and following the law is good. I mean, in the early days, we human beings rebelled against the good, even the perfect laws that were given to us by the God kings in an earlier time when they tried to direct us. Well, you know, the psychology of our planetary logos is that of a rebel, we've been told, and also even in the previous solar system, which involved, of course, our incarnation of our solar logos, there was a rebellion. A certain group rebelled. And, of course, when you rebel against the good law, you're going to set yourself back, and you're going to waste time. Okay, so one gets very inspired by seeing that the law is good. The masters are trying to help us now refollow the good law, and the inevitability of the experience of rebirth will give us that opportunity. Through rebirth, he learns to dominate and utilize form correctly. Maybe you saw that funny movie, you know. You know probably some of you what I'm going to say here. I'm going to talk about Bill Murray. Groundhog Day. Well, it didn't talk about it, but in terms of reincarnation per se, and you can be sure that a lot of these actor types and artist types, they do believe in reincarnation. They have a closer connection with the psyche. Okay, look, I'm at the 2-hour point here, more or less. At least that, and maybe maybe a bit more. So I'm just going to note that. To our point, more or less, on the 10th of, oh, stop, please, 10th of September. I just have to plow through here, you know, because time is short, and if I think about the years until 2025 and how to offer a useful perspective on DK's teaching and at the same time reading it, keeping it in front of us, you know, there is the danger that we may stop reading this magnificent teaching because it is so demanding, and there's a at the end of any age, there's a watering down of effort. We don't want to be part of that watering down. Dilution. So every day this man had to wake up, and until he got it right, it was on a daily basis. He almost knew what he'd have to do until he really met his responsibilities correctly. And the look on his face was marvelous as he just kind of walk around, hold out his arms, and someone would be falling from a second floor window when he caught him. And he just walk on. You know, he's a great comedian. But there was a lot more than comedy in that film. It's a way of introducing the public to the idea of repetition on the way to perfection. In other words, repeat, persistently until we correct and perfect. So that's part of the good law. And one of the laws, the law of cyclic opportunity. Isn't it called that somewhere? Law of rebirth. All forms in themselves are not expressions of a personality. So, you know, that's interesting because we use that term very loosely. Personality as if every human being is a personality. No matter, you know, whatever they do, however they act, their personality, no. And certainly, well, sometimes we look at a dog or a cat and say, look at the personality in that being. And as Master Moria suggested, he says, do not be surprised if a yogi ignores an apparently spiritual type of human being and concentrates on a dog in whom he sees real potential. So what do they see, you know, what can unfold? I already see in our animals very different expressions, which will one day blossom into what we call personality. But anyway, all forms in themselves, certainly not the lower forms. Excuse me. Are not expressions of a personality. To warrant the term, three types of energy must be present, three types, fused, blended, and coordinated into one functioning organism. So that's really important as a definition of personality in a more technical sense. To warrant the term, three types of energy must be present. Obviously, etheric, physical, mental, I mean, emotional, mental, fused and blended and coordinated into one functioning organism. Note. Say so. Note the word coordinated. Well, the age of personality is coming. Leo is the most human of all the signs, we're told, and a lot of people are going to be coordinating their threefold vehicle and producing a personality, and then, of course, it's the tendency of personalities to fight with each other and to seek to be dominant and all that in the earlier stages. So, as DK says, this may present problems of its own, even though it represents advancement. A personality is therefore a blend of mental energy, of emotional energy, and of vital force, and these three are masked, hidden, or revealed, note this terminology, by an outer shell or form of dense physical matter. Such clear definitions. You know, I'm so glad that something hit me on the head and said, okay, just continue with this treatise on white magic. I had the yen to do something else, but I hadn't finished it. Well, you never finish, but I had not offered thoughts on what is said, and it's so rich. A personality is therefore a blend of mental energy, of emotional energy. This time he is calling it energy and not force. Maybe it's only when something radiates forth in a focused manner to affect a lower level of energy that we call it a force. And vital force. Well, there he used the word force. Maybe because it's physical and it's more accessible in some ways. And these three are masked, hidden. Well, we oftentimes have our inner subtle nature concealed by this lunar outer form. You know, the five non-sacred planets. They all are meant to somehow express the nature of a vehicle, like moon, dense, physical, earth, etheric, Mars, astral, Pluto, mental, and sun, the whole personality, probably a secondary planet veiled by the sun. And all of it is lunar in a way, and all of it is veiled by the moon. And the moon veils Vulcan, etheric, physical. The moon veils Neptune, astral. The moon veils Uranus, mental. And the way the moon veils the sun, they have to come together. So we need to unveil, lift the veiling effect of these lunar vehicles and express through these vehicles the higher energies. Personality is therefore a blend of mental energy, of emotional energy, and of vital force. And these three are masked, hidden, or revealed. You know, if things are pure enough, if we've gone through the refinement of the dense physical nature, you know, so that it's no longer opaque or creating the impossibility of light coming through or of light coming through, not just translucently, but transparently. It's revealed by the outer shell or form of dense physical matter. This outer crust is in itself a form of negative energy. You know, we might say from, I don't know where that happens, from an earlier solar system. The result of this union of three energies, now this time he calls them energies, right? Not just vital force, but energies. So sometimes, you know, there's a rigorous use of the words energies and force, and sometimes a looser use. The result of this union of three energies is an objective form. In an objective form is self-consciousness. Eventual self-consciousness, even after individualization, what did it take 3 million years before the dimmest apprehension of I am a separated self really began? Their fusion produces that sense of individuality which justifies the use of the word I and which relates all occurrences to a self. So the fusion of these fields of energy. So to have a real personality, there must be a sense of individuality and what we call it, and outer, what can I call it, I-ness, where the central conscious entity exists, utilizing the mind, reacting sensuously, you know, astrally, through the emotional body, and energizing the dense physical via the vital body, then one has a personality. Okay. So there is this sense of self. This, the emergence of the lower sense of I. A centralized, limited self focusing focusing on the elemental vehicles, i.e. the lunar lords. Okay, I don't know how to do that one. Let's see if I can get it. L-N, L-U, L-D-S, L-N, L-D-S. Okay, we'll call that Lunar Lords. And these are, you know, our unconscious lives, inherited from the previous chain and having to achieve self-consciousness on our globe in this chain. So where this central conscious entity exists, utilizing the mind, reacting sensuously through the emotional body and energizing the dense physical via the vital body, then one has a personality. So focusing on the elemental vehicles, i.e. the lunar lords. So, more definitions of personality. Some very good ones, really. So we don't continue to use the term too loosely. Of course, sometimes one can be a pain to others if one tries to be too precise. It's like D.K. tells us, a disciple can become a burden on his fellow disciples if he runs around working with the law of correspondences and citing correspondences all the time. You know, it gets a little tedious and over precision in a context in which such precision is not going to be appreciated or understood. Is not a wise method. But this is, then one has a personality, it is self-conscious existence in form. Self-conscious existence in form. That's a good summary of the word too, isn't it? So let's really try to take these things in because as students of occultism, we're going to have to, you know the distinction between what is commonly deemed a personality and what really is, resulting in fusion, I-ness, the sense of individuality, self-conscious existence in form, and a limited, very limited self-conscious existence in form. It is a very much a fifth petal phenomenon before the crash takes place. Maybe we should say the blasted tower of the tarot occurs somewhere there in the fifth petal process and everything comes crashing to earth and you pick yourself up sadder, wiser, bruised, pain in pain and say, whoops, what went wrong here? Maybe I ought to measure things a little more proportionately and maybe have a little humility of the kind that comes from seeing the true relative value of things. So this is a personality. And we, you know, at least must understand the technicality, even if we don't always use it with everybody who might not want to bother or appreciate it. It is awareness of identity in relation to other identities, and this is equally true of God or man, because these great beings also have outer forms of expression we can call a personality, but they're so dominated by the inner spiritual structure that they're not, well, what do we know, but probably less at war, let us say, with the inner spiritual being than the human personality is, we being a member of this fourth scorpionic warring kingdom. It is awareness of identity in relation to other identities, I, you, you, I, you know, but it hasn't been bridged yet. And this is equally true of God and man. In a sense, it is a sense of identity, however, which persists only during the creative process. Note the third ray terminology. And for as long as the matter aspect and the consciousness aspect present the eternal duality of nature. Now, we have to realize that this duality will be overcome in consciousness and in fact. In our evolutionary development is not realized in the subhuman forms. Well, yes, no real self-consciousness, even of a limited kind, is existing, but maybe we begin to see that developing in the domestic animals that are shading towards individualization, which can occur even in this round, though most in the next. It is not realized by the subhuman forms. It is realized in the human kingdom and is realized but merged into and negated by the greater forms and consciousness, which we may call the superhuman. So we work our way out of the limiting sense of personality and isolated identity. I'm not sure I'm using that word correctly, because he talks about isolated individuality, isolated identity, and isolated unity. So I don't mean it in the technical sense. They're using the same term he did. We work our way out of it, out of the limiting sense of personality, and I'm going to call it differently, and the apparent isolation of the identity from other identities. In other words, I am I, you are you, ne'er the twain shall meet. We are distinct and separate, when in fact, if we really understood the essence of things, we would realize that we're the same thing. Of course, we don't want that sameness idea to become a platitude. In other words, just words without realization. All these higher words must have be accompanied by realization, and that's where our work comes in. Is it the realization of found on the fifth or third level of the atmic plane? Maybe to a degree, but it's some form of realization where there's a fusion, maybe a Buddhic fusion of identities. Maybe love will help a lot. So behind the apparently separate, we have that which is essentially unified. So this has been very enlightening, at least for me. I mean, this kind of review about what personality really is and where we are justified in using the term and where we are not, fusion, self, I-ness, individuality, distinctness, you know, awareness of identity in relation to other identities. I am I, you are you, you know. Of course, the gods realize they are each other. I had that realization that we all have certain moments, you know, but maybe it was around Waysack time, and I was envisioning the entire hierarchy, or at least the ones, well, not the entire, but a number of the masters with whom we are familiar, and I was visualizing them, you know, standing near or on that great rock where supposedly a ceremony is occurring, maybe on etheric levels. And I looked at them and I realized they were all one being, you know, flash, fast, and maybe not sustained. But, you know, that's the thing to realize, that somewhere behind the sense of distinctness and separation is always the unifying one-making factor. And if we can apply that not only to all human beings, but to all beings, and even to all apparently inanimate objects, really to all perceptions, then we're really getting close there to living in the one as the one. I'll never be satisfied with saying living in the one unless I say as the one. So, and I'm never satisfied saying identification with unless I can say identification as, because that bridges and overcomes the one who is with another. It takes the two and makes it a one. So we're on our way to the superhuman types of consciousness. Certainly the solar angels are superhuman and their extension, the angel of the presence. And maybe we could say that the masters, well, we can't say a master is superhuman, but maybe they are no longer men as are the masters. It says in, is it rule 6 for disciples and initiates? Maybe the Chohans are superhuman. Well, they're still members of the human creative hierarchy. They're not members of a different hierarchy, even though their kingdoms keep rising. And they're in a different kingdom than humanity is right now. Oh, he really goes on, doesn't he? He keeps going with it. Personality is that state of awareness which has its conditioning factor in the mind stuff, but this can be transcended with when that mind stuff no longer controls. Well, I guess, you know, without at least some kind of mental focus, there is no personality. A person can have a very vivid emotional nature, but unless he can integrate those vehicles, hold them together under a direction, will, and purpose, he's not a personality. As the individual mind stuff is an integral part of the universal mind, so there we have the universal mind, you know, extending to quite a relatively low level, even though its true centers are higher on the cosmic physical plane and even higher on the cosmic mental plane, of course. As the individual mind stuff, you just think, you know, the matter in which you think, this mind stuff that you manipulate, it's all part of the universal mind. As the individual mind stuff is an integrated part of the universal mind, and as the principle of mind is inherent in all forms, even the most deeply unconscious forms, the sense of individuality and of self-awareness is always eternally possible, and I want to say eventually. Obviously, you know, we're all the victims of time and process. Time and process. Okay, is it going to allow me to do this? Okay. I don't like that when it... when I get those warning signs, you know. And I'm just hoping that I've succeeded in this. And I always check the time, 14:54 for you. So we're good. We're good. I've had a lot of recoveries to make. It's a big book, a long book. It's got, and in the form that I've got it here, I've got some 750 pages. So every time I save, I'm, you know, manipulating 700, 800 pages. So it's sometimes acting up, you know. Anyway, in the higher states of consciousness, it is, however, eventually relegated to an subordinate, to a subordinate position. I dare say, probably none of us has yet subordinated his personality to a very secondary position. I'm sure, you know, there's an issue even for the initiative of the third degree. And a lot of people approaching the second degree really have a battle on their hands because it's a scorpionic degree, and there's a big conflict with duality, the fighter, as it is said on page 333 of Esoteric Astrology, showing how the advanced man, well, how the undeveloped advanced and disciple initiate react to the various signs of the zodiac. God, for instance, can always and eternally be aware of that reality which constitutes the self and which governs the integrity of the solar system and of the solar interplay with other systems. But the consciousness of divinity and the awareness of the solar deity is not primarily occupied with selfhood. So let's just say that when DK uses the term God, as usual, God in this context, he means the solar logos. Okay, but it's not with selfhood so much, just the way we as group consciousness increases and as we verge towards the one, we're not so interested in the self we used to be or think we were. A larger type of self, which is inclusive of the group and more, emerges. That as a result of past world periods, or that sense of selfhood. Let's see. Let me just copy this. The solar deity is not primarily occupied with selfhood, or at least not in any confined sense. Maybe all beings, once they reach a certain point, are preoccupied with selfhood in the large universal sense and thinking even beyond the universe. How can you say beyond the universe? It all depends how you define universe. But I've been, there's one infinite being, one, only one, nothing else than one infinite being. And I sometimes think of it one absolutely infinite being. And I think, I'm that, you're that, everything is that. What does that mean? When we start thinking of those terms, what really does that mean? So that, as a result of past world periods and experience, in this case, perhaps solar systems. Oh no, that's not it. Wait. Solar systems. Yes, three S's. Perhaps solar systems or periods within the solar logoic process in this solar system. But of course, this is the fifth incarnation of our solar logos as a solar system. And then there'll be another one, and then the sum of them all is the seventh in a way. That, as a result of past world periods and experience, is below the threshold of divine consciousness, just the way our own sense of, oh, I am this, I am that, our little personality sense has to be below the threshold of our consciousness. and has become as much a part of the cosmic instinctual nature as are any of the human instinctual attributes. So, you know, this is the subsiding of sologoic personality consciousness. That's what we're talking about here. And for us too, you know, as we really begin to live in the soul, it's a very subtle thing, I guess, or in something more, we're just not going to be attending to our apparently distinct individuality in the three worlds. It's an instrument, we use it, but we don't have to think about it. Have you thought, you know, even in using the mind, how often you just say things automatically and correctly while being automatic? The use of the mind on that level is just become second nature. It's become instinctual. The focus of the eternal attention, if I may use so unusual a phrase, where words are necessarily almost worthless, kind of have, you know, compassion for the Tibetan as he tries to convey these very lofty things to us in our own paltry words. The focus of the eternal attention lies in realms of awareness beyond our comprehension. Okay, so, you know, for the Soto Logos, what is the cosmic mind? What is cosmic intuition? Well, we can barely understand what is the higher mind for us on a systemic level and what is intuition on a systemic level on the cosmic physical plane. So it's just a verbal analogy, but at least it preserves a certain orderly structure in the mind. And that's very necessary. They lie as far beyond our ken as the awareness of a master of wisdom lies beyond the ken of an ant or a mouse. I guess a mouse knows a lot more than an ant. But that is one of those proportional analogies which really gives you pause, doesn't it? Gives me pause, I'll tell you. So, the eternal attention of the Soto Logos, it's an ongoing attention. It lasts for ages. It is sustained. It is stable. It may not last forever because the Soto Logos is an isolated or distinct being. There are no distinct beings. There are only distinct beings in the Mahamaya. You want to say, what was I doing five universes ago? You weren't doing anything. You were only the universal logos of that instantiation of absolute infinity five universes ago. But you can't trace what you call yourself now, even to the last universe, let alone an infinite regression of universes. So, you know, beyond the human mind, you almost have to give it up, but maybe not quite. Okay. So the eternal focus of the eternal attention of the Soto Logos, if I may use so unusual a phrase, where words are necessarily almost worthless, lies in realms of awareness beyond our comprehension. I wonder if we appreciate the visits of masters and shohans into our realm, given what they are aware of. We expect, you know, Master DK is speaking in very human terms. It's like kindergarten for him. He's talking in a way to people that they can understand, but the real concentration that he wants to, or over which he has control, is focused way beyond what we can fathom. So it is therefore fruitless. I love this because sometimes these big analogies just drive the point home, don't they? They lie as far beyond our ken. Ken means, of course, knowledge. As the awareness of a master of the wisdom, and that's not even us. I guess our consciousness is a bit beyond an ant or a mouse too, but just think of a master and a mouse. As an ant or a mouse. Okay. Think. This would be fun, you know. I'm going to just say here, think of the story of the master and the mouse. Well, you know, and then I want to carry that analogy a little further. Just think of what the universal logos, in whom galaxies are just the tiniest chakras, just minute chakras. Think of that consciousness in comparison with the analogy we've just been given. So humility comes by studying these kinds of contrasts. We see people today just so self-important and swept up in their culture, assuming its dominance over others, and their race assuming its dominance and superiority over others. And it's just, in the larger sense, such nonsense. But then again, the consciousness is limited, and people go with what they think they know. Racism today in the world is rising again here at the in a period during the first fifth of the 21st century, and people are very excited about being white and therefore better than others. But it's such a limited point of view, isn't it? But how then to open the door of the mind so that it can take in the larger possibilities without dismissal, without scorn, without laughter, you know, because it's so different from what has been accepted as true. It is therefore fruitless for us to dwell upon it. For us, there is the achieving of personality, or of a full registration or awareness of the indwelling self. So the real personality is being hinted at here. The real personality is simply the instrument of the soul. If we ever make the mistake, which would be a violation of the Four Noble Truths, that this personality existing in the phenomenal worlds is real, well, then we're just the victim of mistaken identity, and it will hold us in thrall for a long time. For us, there is the achieving of personality, or of a full registration of awareness of the indwelling self, that this is real personality. So this is the soul-infused personality. There must be I have to have done this, don't you think so? The soul, what? Soul infused, S-L-I-F-D, P. S-L-I-P-R, slipper. S-L-I-P-R. Well, glad I looked it up. And slippers, too. Oh, my. All right. S-L-I-P-R. There's the soul-infused personality. And this is personality as it should be. Yeah, this is personality as it should be, and not as it is, often as the opponent of the soul. There lies then the utilization of that personality as an instrument, right? And its sacrifice eventually to group good, increasingly towards the fourth initiation, towards the fourth initiation and thence instinctively, with a consequent merging of the self in the oneself and the fusion of the individual soul, if there is such a thing, consciously and willingly in the over soul. So this is the goal. This is the goal. And how close we are to that? Well, everyone must make his or her own assessment. So, personality will not go away, and even the Maya Varupa is a kind of a covering, a kind of a personality. The utilization of that personality and its sacrifice, eventually to group good. Oh, it will fight and scream. It will kick. It will protest. But what is the group you're trying to serve, you know, and how do you make those keen discriminations? Which group are you serving? In a way, you can maybe serve the whole planet, you know, but there are certain closer to home groups that you really are serving, and are you doing it correctly? The sacrifice of the personality, in other words, you don't always get your way, right? I want my way, says the dominating personality. And there are other ways if the personality came into a position of proportional humility or the realization of right proportion inducing humility. And so there's this consequent merging of the self with the oneself. Well, that's the name of the game, and by the third initiation, this should have taken place to a large extent. And the fusion of the individual soul, well, it's a state of consciousness, a limited state of consciousness with the consciously and willingly with the oversoul. You know, in a way, Christ, in a way, Christ in the Garden of hoping that's spelled correctly. A still larger issue came to the attention of the Christ as he became aware of the will of Sanatkumara, the Father in heaven. And the Christ's method of going forward was good, higher than anything we could conceive of, but not the best, not that which his superior, the Father in heaven, deemed necessary. So always there is the service of the larger and larger group. Now, you can get into a glamour about that, and you say, well, I'm serving the planet, I'm serving the whole system, solar system, I'm serving the, you know, great galactic council, and you're just inflating yourself as you go. You got to figure out what group it is that you really are serving, and then the manner in which you subordinate yourself accordingly. Now, this is a popular point here coming up. I am the cry of every human being. I am that, the cry of every personality who realizes his selfhood and uses his personality in order to express the will of the indwelling entity, the true person. Okay, so what do we have here? The soul is the, quote, true person. I am that I am, or I am that and that am I, you know, but this is what God said, I am that I am, the cry of the individual soul, as it is lost in the whole and realizes its oneness with the soul or self of all. He's not really capitalizing things here, you know, I guess that's somewhat up to the editor. I would really capitalize a lot of this just to remind myself, you know, what's really happening. So this is a really important statement. And we always, in our full moon meditations, we distinguish between I am that, and I am that I am. But here he's very specific about the sources of these mantras. I am the cry of every human being who, you know, at least has begun to observe that he is distinct from that which he, apparently distinct from that which he finds in the environment. You know, at first, that germ of possible discrimination of the self from the not self takes time to grow. Like, you know, DK gives it 3 million years, and the babe awoke after 3 million years, after the arrows shot forth, you know, the extension of the solar angel shot forth, giving the seed of individuality and the beginning of individualization to earth chain humanity, at least. It was done differently in other systems and on other chains. I am the cry of every human being. I am that, the cry of every personality, see, who realizes his selfhood and uses his personality in order to express the will of the indwelling entity. He realizes that he is the soul. This is his selfhood. And the true person, the indwelling entity, the true person. Okay, let's call it the soul is the true person, or let's just call it, or more specifically, the SLII, the soul in incarnation. I am that I am, the cry of the individual soul, or at least consciousness in a limited state, thinking that it is distinct, a distinct being, the cry of the individual soul as it is lost in the whole and realizes its oneness with the soul or self of all. But that lost in the whole, let's see, that soul must have realized the one, and maybe not all souls do. So, you know, it's what I'm finding here is that this book is the repository of many things, mantras, sentences, statements that have been made in relation to the teaching, and which are repeated in relation to the teaching. Yes, these are important statements, the source of which is in this book. The characteristic of the individual who is beginning to function as a personality might be briefly enumerated as follows. Okay, so how the personality functions at first. They are simple and clear and preeminently selfish. Well, because the consciousness has not expanded to include a larger sense of identity. Let it not be forgotten that the primitive step on the way to selfhood of necessity is selfishness. We don't just want to be at first just lost in the great sea of awareness without being able to recognize what it is, control it, realize one's relationship to it. So selfishness is a consolidating stage. Selfishness is a stage of consolidation. Let it be equally well remembered that the prime hindrance to the advanced and highly evolved personality is selfhood, or the prolongation of the selfish attitude. Now, it's very clear, you know, this idea, excuse me, of what primarily is the Black Lodge guilty of the prolongation of the selfish attitude. You might almost say the institutionalization of the selfish attitude, you know, and really this is the building of a separate vehicle called the concrete mental vehicle, isolated from the higher self. And he says, really, it's the number 13, it's the greatest disaster that can overtake or befall a human being at this time. The characteristics, therefore, are in their sequential development as follows. So this is the development of the personality sequentially. One, the ability to say, I am, I wish, I desire, I will, pounding the I. Okay, reinforcing the really tiny center of the vehicles comprised of the lunar lords. Number two, the consciousness of being in the center of one's own tiny universe. Around me the heavens move, and their stars in their courses revolve, is the motto at this stage. So what do we have here? You know, really self-centered, and it all revolves around me. Well, that is a stage forward, because at least there is centralization. You're not just demanding. One is not just demanding. One is centralizing. Okay. Righty. Okay, one is, in control of one's little domain without realizing how very little it is. Now we see some, you know, dictators and politicians filled with the sense of their own petty selfhood, and it's really a very small country they're ruling, but they don't know it. They don't know it. Then number three, the sense of drama and the capacity to visualize oneself at the center of one's environment. The centralized self seeks to emphasize itself and have an effect through drama and impression upon other selves. All right. Well, we've all, you know, it's a stage. I sometimes wonder what I was doing directing operas for 20 years, where all those characters had to be emphasized through song and arias and dramatic situations, and it all went through me, and I had to live out every part, maybe some kind of recapitulation. We go through these things. Number four, the sense of responsibility and the aptitude to regard the surrounding members of the human family as dependent upon one. A bit selfish, but helpful. And the first sign of soul influence is the growth of the sense of responsibility. Okay, responsibility. Then let's go on. This is fascinating, I mean, you can just see us moving petal by petal as we go along. There really is no personality until the fifth petal. There's the beginning of it, so to speak, but in the fourth petal maybe, but the real centralization, the real domination, control, sense of selfhood, impressive sense of selfhood. It's a fifth petal issue. The sense of importance, the outgrowth of the above. This demonstrates in power and influence where there is real and steadily awakening entity behind the persona, and in braggadocio and bombast, where there is a, where a small, selfish creature functions. Well, history will tell, but I think we're witnessing that on the world stage. Right now, you can draw your own conclusions. Yeah, we see it. That's self-importance. We it's the dictator's attitude, and maybe in the modern world, in modern times, and if we leave Rome out of it a bit, the most recent megalomaniacal example was Hitler. Mussolini was, imitating a bit, but he just didn't really have it. He had that Leo thing, I think it's the Sun in Leo and Scorpio rising. And DK said that Leo was the influential in the soul horoscope of Hitler. He hadn't really studied it in terms of the normal horoscope, personality horoscope. Braggadocio, bombast, where a small selfish creature functions. He did tell one of his disciples, LTSK, he said, look, you're working through a small, and then he emphasized a very small personality. He wasn't a bad man. He was a good man in many ways, but DK just wanted him to expand the situation and become more disciplic. Okay. So responsibility can be good, and it can lead to increased capacity and efficiency and importance. Then comes that sense of importance, and okay, is it good? Is it bad? It just depends on whether there's a real and steadily awakening entity in there. We might say, if we look at this, is the soul in incarnation awakening behind the personal exterior? Then there's the power to use the entire equipment. I want to give myself a little space here. Whoop. The power to use the entire equipment so that the mind and brain function synchronously and the emotional nature is thereby subordinated, inhibited, or controlled. And this involves the steady growth of the power of thought. so many dictators have a emotional body out, no, emotional, EMB, sorry, out of control. And they are impulsive. You know they are impulsive. And this should be set the numbering tones. Okay. Right. So when you really begin to think, the sense of proportion can be what you could. If you really begin to think about yourself objectively, then the then humility is on its way. So many dictatorial types seem to accept that they themselves, good or bad, are the most important thing in the world, and they don't try to live according to any higher standard. Then, let's see, we're going on here. The capacity to live a coordinated life so that the entire man functions and is guided by purpose, expressing the energy of will by desire, expressing the energy of the emotional psychic nature and by vitality, which swings the physical vehicle into line with the purpose or desire. So this is, what do we have here? This is really integrated personality. Now, is it necessarily good? It's hard to say, because you can have an evil purpose. I was just studying Tojo, Hideaki Tojo, the famous warlord of Japan, who just subsumed under himself all the authority of running the war eventually, and he wanted this huge Japanese empire. And he realized Japan has insufficient raw materials, so let's go out and invade other countries such as China and get the raw materials we needed. And eventually, and he was motivated by racism of all things, the superiority of the Japanese racially. Well, a Capricorn, and as DK tells us, the best and the worst of Capricorn, best and worst people are found in Capricorn. Japan has a Capricorn personality. Did it have a Capricorn personality at that time? I don't know, but. And the whole samurai thing is Scorpio, and it looks to me like he might have had Scorpio rising or an important Scorpio element in his chart. So is being efficient, powerful, successful, is it necessarily good? Well, it is effective. And then finally, you know, the power to influence, sway, guide, and hold others within the range of individual purpose and desire. So Tojo, he really ran the war. He had a close alliance with the emperor, but the emperor was interested basically in marine biology, you know. And he seemed more a hapless victim of all that unfolded within the Japanese psyche as it was overshadowed by the negative forces and thence represented the obstacle we call Maya, Germany glamour and Italy illusion. So is it good? Well, all right. Now we may find ourselves going on and describing something that goes beyond the personal consciousness. But this has given us a great example of how things evolve, you know. You emphasize what your elemental vehicles want. You're at the center. You're really the only thing in your own sight. you can impress yourself upon your environment through the sense of drama, gesturing and calling attention to yourself. You can increase your power and make others dependent upon you, and thus your sense of importance grows. And that sense of importance can work out in a couple of different ways, either as inflation, you know, inflating your own value in relation to the environment. We call that braggadocio. You become a braggart and exaggerate your own importance and what you can do. Or, you know, perhaps you just are becoming more important in your environment because the soul in incarnation is awakening behind your outer abilities. And then finally, you start subordinating all of your equipment, because you can have mental focus and the emotional nature doesn't get out of control. And so you become, I don't know, maybe a little less selfish, potentially. And then total coordination. Yes, you finally can follow purpose and follow it well. But now what are the purposes? That's the issue. Tojo certainly had a great purpose. And Hitler, you know, who was more than half mad, had a great purpose. And it was all about the empire of their nations, the expansion of their nations with whom they identified. You know, as Louis the 14th? He said, l'état c'est moi, I am the state. So these people, you know, Hitler could pretty well say, I am Germany, and Tojo, I am Japan, and Mussolini, I am Italy. They all had a very powerful fourth ray, all those countries. They could say that, and they identified with the imperialism, the expansion of their country, carving up the world and taking their share of it all. Hitler was overjoyed when he found out that Japan was entering the war, because he said, now we have, as an ally, a nation which has never lost a war. Well, there's always got to be a first. And then finally, you know, you really reach the acme of personality power. Okay. So finally, the acme of personality power. And interestingly, DK says that that stage lies behind a lot of us who maybe have spent one or two lives in a monastery or a convent or in some cloistered state, examining the self, seeing to the self, putting the self in order, of kind of a Virgo stage following a dominating Leo stage. Heights of notable service can be reached in Leo, DK tells us, and in Aquarius. But you have to go through the fall of the tower before that can happen. So within this stage, when this stage has been reached, the three energies which constitute the personality have been successfully fused and merged, and the mechanism or instrument of the indwelling self is a usable and valuable asset. Now the question is, will we give in to the dweller? You know, we're told, remember, that if you are on the first ray and you give in to the dweller, you become a destroyer of souls. And on the second ray, you become a deluder of souls. And on the third ray, you become a manipulator of souls. You can be quite powerful personally, but, you know, choice has to be made, and you have to set your thought form on the proper path. And you have that Libran choice between the right and the left-hand path, and that is presented after the power-making second initiation in the desert by yourself. The man is a potent personality and becomes the center of a group. doesn't mean the group is spiritual, necessarily. He finds himself to be the focal point for other lives and is an influential magnetic individual, swaying others, coordinating human units into groups and organisms. Okay. Okay. So anyway, he holds sway. He holds sway, as they say. Swaying others, and we're told, you know, from the soul perspective, no one has the right to sway a brother's mind, to compel him to act as one would act. No one has the right. Okay. But that's if you're functioning as a soul, a true aspirant, and are developing that higher perspective. The man is a potent personality and becomes the center of a group. We see it all the time. He finds himself to be the focal point for other lives. He tells them what to do. He gets a sense of satisfaction out of doing that. And the people he tells feel more certain about their life and rightly guided. And he's an influential, magnetic individual. He attracts others, swaying others, coordinating human units into groups. We see it, you know, outside the spiritual field, into groups and organisms. Okay. So this is the climax of being a personality. He talks about the exaltation of the personality. Sometimes it's a very good thing. He becomes the head of an organization and of parties, of religious and political bodies, and of nations in some cases. Just look at our various presidents and leaders. You know, what initiatory state are they at? Are they dominant personalities? Are they influenced by the soul? Where do they stand? Thus do the dominant personalities come into being and find themselves. They discover thus the distinction between the center of power, the self, and the equipment, and they finally become conscious of vocation, the calling, in the true sense of the term. The emergent dominant personality doesn't, it's a first-rate stage, but it doesn't, you don't necessarily have to be a first-rate type. There's other ways to become the dominant personality. You can become dominant from seven different perspectives. It should be noted that this sequential development is paralleled by an inner growth of soul awareness, though the mode of expression of that inner growth is largely dependent upon the ray upon which the spiritual entity is found. I guess I was saying the same thing in a less eloquent manner. Okay, now. So, you know, gradually, if all is going well, this brilliant personality, this excellent, capable personality is accompanied by a growing sense of soul awareness. The soul in incarnation is awakening, and the personality is gradually becoming subordinated. Now, where we don't have a subordination of the personality, we have real material for the Black Lodge, for the left-hand path, if the individual persists in seeking power and intelligence without love. It's the relationship principle which has to come in at this point. Otherwise, without it, we deviate onto the left-hand path, and the sense of the cosmic Christ following the Syrianly inspired path of initiation just doesn't happen. And maybe there are other opportunities for redemption along the way, but that's it. One can take the wrong path and lead oneself to a fate worse than death, you know, to dissolution. One can lead oneself to dissolution in terms of the present solar system and have to in a way, monadically, start all over again. Okay, now I'm going to say this is it. And I don't know what page we're on here. This is page 395. And 395. So we've gone from 386 to 395. And we have worked through about three programs in one. And I know it's a horror for people transcribing, but then probably, you know, after trying to transcribe what I say, since it's a little bit conversational and anecdotal and all that, one just says, well, maybe it's not really worth it. All right. But at least my book on the Egoic Lotus is in process. So we're ending number 45. And it's from 386 to 395. And this is really number 30, isn't it? I don't know how I got 28 there. Okay, no, that's not it. 10.30. It's the 30th program. I do believe and hope it is. Yes, it is. And it's number 46. And we're going to be starting number 47. And we'll be starting with 31. And today is the 10th of September. And that really belongs over here. Right? Okay. And rule 10:31. All right, well, we've done maybe 9 pages, maybe an average of 3 per hour. And I really don't know how it is that I failed to do the right notation over here, because this was the end of 44 and commentary. Yeah, this should have been number 29, or maybe 29 was, this should have been number 30, and the end of 29. That would have been better and more correct. And 387, really, to 395. Okay, maybe I got so carried away with that ancient Atlantean commentary that I got my pages mixed up. I know this is a little bit dull, but 387. And we're going to start here with rule 10, 395. All right, now I think I've got it correct. If there are little things that are wrong, they can be straightened out as we go along. Okay. And that's probably been there for a while and doesn't need to be there. Shouldn't be there. All right, friends. So that's it. Let's see if I can convert this for you. And as time allows, I will go forward. 200 pages to go. 200 of these computer pages. That's still a lot, and we're nowhere near the end of Rule 10 yet. We've done 30 programs on it. It's a ponderous treatise. And of course, you've just got to read it the way DK wrote it. But if having done that, you want some additional idea input and correlations and cross-correlations and a somewhat Mercurian treatment, then these may be of value for you. Okay? Lots of love, many blessings, study hard, how can you help it, you know? We have 7 years to assimilate what we can before the new installments start coming out. And hopefully we will have the wisdom to recognize them. See you soon. Bye-bye.